Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 170, entitled How to Be Unbreakable, Life Lessons from a Navy SEAL, I chat with Tom Shea. Tom Shea is a highly decorated former Navy SEAL and recipient of numerous distinguishable honors, including the Silver Star, and he's also the current CEO of Adamantine Alliance. In today's episode, Tom talks about his experience in being a Navy SEAL and the many lessons he learned from his time in this elite military branch. He talks about the toughness that was instilled in him from an early age and the unwavering determination for success he cultivated as he grew older. Tom discusses how he developed an unbreakable attitude in life and shares the 13 lessons that others can follow to do the same. From war stories to mindset mastery, this episode is action-packed and fascinating as hell. If you're wondering how to develop the unbreakable spirit and mindset of a true American hero, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. Hey, if you haven't signed up for the Elite Man newsletter yet, go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. This is an incredible newsletter which helps you become the best man you can be. Every single week, we give you the best tips, strategies, and techniques for helping you master your personal, social, and business life and give you exclusive content not seen nor heard on the podcast or anywhere else. That's elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. Sign up right now. And now, a word from our fantastic Elite Man podcast sponsors.
Hey, I've got some fantastic news. We've just released our brand new calcium supplement. We're very excited about this as we know how essential calcium is in the body and how important it is to consume every day. Our calcium is made with calcium carbonate, which is one of the most popular and effective forms of calcium on the market. Plus, we add in 25 micrograms, 1,000 IUs of vitamin D3 to improve your body's absorption of calcium and synergistically increase its benefits. Calcium, as you know, is great for building strong bones and teeth, but what you may not know is that it's also incredibly important for muscle function, nerve transmission, hormone balancing, and regulating your sleep, to name just a few of the many, many functions. It's truly one of the most important nutrients for the body, and it's critical to get enough of it every single day. Oh, and by the way, this calcium works great with our magnesium citrate and can provide a perfect 1-2 punch for ensuring you're at your very best when it comes to bone health, muscle function, nerve function, sleep regulation, and the myriad of other crucial processes they both regulate in the body. Go to elitelifenutrition.com/calcium to order now. Again, that's elitelifenutrition.com/calcium. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com, and my guest today is Tom Shea from adamantinealliance.com. Tom, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm really excited about today's episode. I mentioned in the intro a couple minutes before, you're a highly decorated Navy SEAL, served, I believe, in 3 wars and won a whole bunch of medals and prestigious accolades, of course, going along with that. In today's episode, I want to focus on the book you came out a couple of years back called Unbreakable and some of the lessons you talk about in the book. But before we dive into some of those lessons and the techniques and tactics for being unbreakable, I want to dive into your backstory of being a Navy SEAL. What drew you into that life, and how did that unfold? Like, how did you get into becoming a Navy SEAL? I know it's a long process, probably a number of years of just incredibly tough, hard work, but what, I guess, drew you to that to begin with?
It's an interesting question. So I grew up in a small town in South Indiana or Southern Indiana, where I think I lived in that period of time where you really thought you could do anything, and my parents were conducive to the fact that, hey, you can do anything you want to do, but you got to earn your way to achieving that. And what really got me into it, other than my parents backing everything that I attempted, was I grew up with a guy who had been a Navy SEAL before it was Navy SEALs, and he'd been the first one on the island of Iwo Jima about 3 hours before the invasion. And why I think that's significant to talk about is he was 17, and his story of overcoming terrible adversity, I grew up in that. I grew up listening to his tales and listening to his lifestyle, and I liked it, except out of high school, my dad said, you will not become a Navy SEAL. So I went to West Point instead. Not that it's less, it's just I had initially taken a different track, and I failed out after my third year. And I went back home with my leg between, or my tail between my legs, and the guy who I'd grown up with, who had been a precursor to the SEALs, he said, now that you're at the bottom, you can do anything. And I kind of, maybe I was naive. I said, well, you know what, Pat, what I really wanted to be was a Navy SEAL. He goes, do it. And so I immediately went out and signed up for the SEAL program. And I didn't even know how to swim when I signed up for it. And the rest became a series of unfortunate accidents that I just never gave up on myself.
Wow. Wow, that's an incredible story. What was it? I'm curious. What was it before the Navy SEALs? That you, the guy you knew, what was he in?
They were called. They were a group called Scouts and Raiders, and they had gone through a similar training, and they had a hell week involved in their training, which is basically 6 days no sleep, get beat up beyond recognition, and survive it. And then they threw them into combat scenarios that were unwinnable, and they constantly came out ahead. But it was called Scouts and Raiders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And wow, that's really interesting. So you went to West Point and failed out of it after 3 years. What part of it did you not succeed in? Was it the academic side of things?
Yeah, I laugh now that I'm 50, but when I was 25, I wasn't laughing. But I'd failed out in English.
Oh, wow.
And which I think is funny now, because later as an adult male, I ended up writing a book, but I always laugh at that. But I failed out because I literally got overwhelmed. And I, you know, as a man, I look back and I know I gave up. I just couldn't take whatever they were giving me. And it always shows up academically at that place. But yeah, I failed out academically.
It seems like that you gave up because you weren't really interested in pursuing that career path. And I think maybe in the back of your mind, you had other intentions, whether you knew it was going to be a Navy SEAL or not. Is that fair to say?
Agreed. It was not what I have no cut on the place. And my daughter's there in her second year. So everybody listening, I still support the academy. But no, I it was not something that called to me. And it's always an uphill battle into the wind, so to speak, when you're doing something in your life that doesn't drive you to do it.
So you get into the Navy SEAL training. What is that like in the beginning? Is it a complete culture shock? Is it intense, crazy, beyond what you thought it was going to be? Or did you just kind of go with the flow and it wasn't really that extreme for you?
I think it's extreme for everybody. Mm-hmm. And even from inception to date, it still has an 80% attrition rate. So for me, it was out of control. Like if you have a level of 1 to 10, what your expectations, I thought it would be a 10 and it ended up like a 40.
Wow.
And I started and I got to Hell Week in the first class that I was in and got injured. And as long as you don't quit, at least then, as long as you don't quit, they'll keep you in the program. So since I didn't quit, I just got injured. I was allowed to heal and I had to start all over again at the beginning. And I got to Hell Week again the second time and dislocated my shoulder. And since I didn't quit, they said, oh, hey, we'll keep you in, but you got to get back in the program athletically. So I was allowed to miss a class, and I started again in my third class and got pneumonia in Hell Week.
Wow.
And it's easier to recover from a shoulder dislocation than it is pneumonia. So they allowed me to start again, and I had pneumonia when I started. And I was at the back of the class, and I'd never recovered from it. So again in Hell Week, it manifested itself with all five of my lobes of my lungs about 40% infiltrated with fluid, and they kicked me out of training. And I had to go work in the regular Navy. It was supposed to be 2 years, but I basically submitted a request every day for 9 months to go back. And I think the admiral felt sorry for me, and he signed it and immediately got back there. All the instructors were the same. And in class 207, we started with 111, and we graduated 11.
Wow, that is intense. So, wow, that's incredible, man. So every day for 9 months, you had to, you wrote a letter to try to get back into it. That just, I think, showed everybody that could have allowed you to get back into the group that you were serious about doing it and you were determined to make it happen.
Yeah, even writing the letter was, I say it kind of interestingly enough, there was not a lot of support. And at that point in time, my parents weren't even supporting it. They're like, Tom, you're going to die. Or you're going to injure yourself beyond recognition. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to come home anymore because it's too difficult to try these hard things without the people that you love supporting you. And I'm like, I'm not going to back away. I've already failed once, four times in the SEAL program. I'm going to do this or I'm going to die doing it. And you don't have a lot of friends when that happens because everybody thinks they're looking out for your well-being. And you know, maybe it wasn't the right call at the time. But I just felt more embarrassed that I'd failed, and I wasn't going to fail again. By the time I went back, my mindset was much more keen to making it through.
What type of mindset did you have? What type of like determination? What were some of the thoughts going on in your head during this time to make you want to go back and not give up? And you know, like everybody else, I think you said the number was like 111 guys, and only like 10 or so guys passed. 11 guys passed. What was because you obviously had that right mindset to not give in. What's the mindset like? What's the focus like? What is your thought process like during this time to make you push past all the crap that you have to face and all the things that make other people quit?
It's I call it clarity. I had one singular focus point in my head or my mind, and that was to get to the end, and nothing else mattered. And I you kind of need that in any aspect of your life at some point in time. And I just kept focusing on the end. Whatever I was going through, I didn't really give a shit about, and it hurt. And SEAL training is about how much you can tolerate. And then you think you've had enough and they give you more. So I stopped paying attention to all the distractions that can pull you out. I'm like, whatever it takes to get to the end, that's what I'm going to do. If I have to drown to get there, then I'll drown. And it allowed me to have less stress looking at the next day, each day. Like, it doesn't matter. I don't care. I'm just going to do whatever they ask me to do. And it actually makes you more trainable. When you come to work, it doesn't matter what work's going to give me. I'm going to do whatever it takes. So that was my mindset. And I took that into my career, have a single point of focus and disregard everything else.
Where does that single point of focus come from? Where does that clarity really stem from? Is it something like maybe in your upbringing, your childhood that you carried with you throughout the years? Or is it something that as you developed your desire to want to be a Navy SEAL, that just came to the forefront of your mind and you had that unwavering conviction to make sure it happened no matter what?
I look at it now as I'll answer it this way. That it only comes from failing. And when if you succeed too easily in things, I think the endeavor is too simple. Mm-hmm. And once you've failed, you stop chasing distracting things. And you stop, chasing nice, good idea butterflies that are cool, but they don't help you. And once you've hit bottom a couple times, you recognize, I think everybody that has failed recognizes all the stuff that is not important, don't pay attention to it. And it allows you to pick one thing each day that you have to get or accomplish as opposed to the 100,000 things that you can accomplish. And that's how I've gotten to it, is by hitting rock bottom and failing often, you get to the realization that, hey, just do one thing really well today. Don't do 100 things, do one, and have a single point of focus as much as you can in whatever you're doing.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think it's a great way to clear things up and really get people back on task as failure. It actually can be one of the biggest leverages to success, right? Like having that failure and falling down and being and having nothing, it pushes you to get back up and to get something to, and whether it's every single day getting something like smaller, even if it's incrementally, or you know, sometimes you'll have like big days where you'll have some great success. I think having that overall focus of your future and projecting yourself into the future is one of the best ways to do it. Tom, did you have any fear though, like when you're going through this, that maybe you made the wrong decision? You have all these people, even your family, your friends, your superiors telling you that they didn't want it. It took you 9 months for them to accept you back in. Was there any like second guessing yourself, like maybe you were doing the wrong thing and maybe this Navy SEAL life wasn't cut out for you?
Yeah, every day that ended in why. And that is what I was distracted by, because on the first iteration that it didn't work out, I got injured. I started questioning myself, and that became a distraction, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it didn't allow me to focus on the simple tasks that were, you know, that you were supposed to be doing. Is it right for me? And then my, you know, a girlfriend says, "Hey, you know, you look terrible," and then you get distracted by that. And so when I went back, there was just singularity, and I stopped questioning if it was the right thing. I heard the conversation in my head often, "Gosh, this is stupid. Why the hell are you doing this?" Like, oh, well, it's a distraction. And there's a million distractions if you pay attention to them. And there's one thing to do. Just go do that one thing. And yes, and I literally stopped paying attention to all the naysayers and the distracting elements that happen, you know, in SEAL training, but I just stopped paying attention to them in my life.
Is that how you deal with fear too? Like if something during that time or even now that pops up that you may be afraid of or something that challenges you in a certain way, how do you currently deal with different fears and different anxieties that may pop up?
Well, I would have to define fear. So I do that. So fear by my definition is the absence of action. And it's an emotional response that I think it's golden to have fear, because sometimes it's needed. You know, I'm afraid I'm going to die if I run into a burning building. It's probably smart to have some element of fear, but fear is crippling. You have to unwrap fear because it prevents you from doing anything of value, really. And so every time I notice that I'm kind of crippled and not in action, the only solution to anything that you're afraid of is to turn and go do it. Mm-hmm. And it takes seasons to be good at facing fears. And now I probably have some, I just don't recognize it anymore. If I'm afraid something's going to happen, I go do it. If I'm afraid to fail at something, I just go fail at it. Okay, now it's knocked out. Don't have to be afraid of it anymore. You've screwed it up. Now let's solve it. Hmm. And, you know, like even speaking in public, which for some reason is like the nation's biggest fear.
Yeah.
The only way to overcome that is you got to go talk in public. Hmm. The moment you do it, it's gone. And everybody has that. Everybody has something they're afraid of doing. Well, go do it. And the moment they try it, they're like, it wasn't so bad. Exactly.
Yeah. No, I love that, man. And you're 100% right, too, especially with the speaking thing. Is like, even like now, if I do speeches, you know, get on stage, like the first maybe minute or so, 2 minutes max, it's like you have like that anxious energy, that excitement, like kind of nervous energy about you. But like, after you start doing it every single time, like it gets easier too every time you do it. Like speaking's nothing anymore to me. But even like in the first minute or two when you're up there, it's like you still have that nervous energy. But after you're like in the flow of it, you look up 5-10 minutes into it, and it's like, you know, you have zero anxiety anymore, zero fear about doing it, because you just embraced it and you're in the moment of actually doing it. I love the quote of fear is the absence of action. I think that's like so dead on, man, for sure.
It's. You can really unpack that in everything, whether it's fear of speaking or, you know, I'm afraid to look bad. Go look bad. I'm afraid to do a job interview. Okay, go screw up a job interview intentionally, but you have to move towards it. And I'll tell a weird story if we have enough time. So the SEAL program is designed around constantly facing unwinnable conditions. The more you constantly face them, you stop even analyzing that you can win or lose. You just act. And the first person to act in the face of fear wins. And the SEAL program is also designed around constant failure. It's the only organization that I know, even in business, in the business world now, everybody doesn't want to fail. So the SEAL program designs everything around pushing everything to the brink of failure. And then you take 10 more steps past it. You can't win ever in training. They don't let you. You can't do anything well. If it goes too well, they'll mock kill somebody. Then you got 10 people you got to drag. I didn't anticipate that happen. And you constantly are dealing with everything falling apart. So by the time you go into combat, it's the only time you can actually win, or somebody's not going to artificially do something to destroy it. And for SEALs, the only time they do well in their life is in combat situations. And that's interesting that everybody, all the SEALs, wants to constantly go back into combat because it's the only time they do well.
That's really interesting how they train you that way. If you think about it, it's the perfect way to train somebody. Like, give them all this crap and, you know, make sure they fail constantly in training, so they're geared, they're wired towards that other place where they actually do get that success. And that other place happens to be war or combat or doing missions. And I mean, I wonder if that's really how they thought of it, like in terms of that being like the overall dynamic of things, or if that's just more the way they conditioned the training to be, and then that's sort of the result of it.
They actually thought about that.
Yeah, it's very clever.
You have to, when you're designing a program that is, everything is nebulous in combat. There's not, hey, we're going to do this and it's going to work out. Everything is gray. So the guys that, the original guys who started the SEAL program knew that the only way to combat that, if you will, was to constantly in training make things overwhelming and difficult and nebulous and out of control. And the moment you get control, they take it from you, so that you condition yourself to not require clarity, just action. And so they put thought into it, and I hate them for it, but that it works every single time.
Yeah, no, it definitely seems like it, man, for sure. So what was the single toughest part of the whole experience of being a Navy SEAL? Was it the training beforehand? Was it the missions you had to do? Was it some of the overseas conflicts you endured? I mean, what was, if you could pinpoint like the toughest time in being a Navy SEAL, what would that be?
The actual combat. Case in point, one time in 2009, I was a platoon chief in Afghanistan, and we got our butts handed to us. We were outnumbered. We were getting overrun. And everything started slipping way out of control. I lost communication through the radio system with the rest of my unit. And I was pinned down by myself, which is a terrible place to be. And I was on the brink of quitting. And the only thing that got me back into it was, hey, I just need to do one simple thing. I can shoot. So I started processing, do one thing. And the conditions were not nice. And I could describe them, but it gets really out of control. Mm-hmm. And I was, instead of processing 10,000 things that were very urgent, I said, well, I just need to move over there and I need to shoot that guy. And I processed one thing at a time. And after 45 minutes, we all ran out of ammo and ended up calling a bomb close to our position, pretty much on top of us. and it killed all the enemy, and we all survived.
Wow.
And I don't recommend that to anybody, but it was just the ability to not give up, which everybody has that ability, and process one simple thing and then process another simple thing. And eventually you make your way through it. But the guarantee is that when you quit, it all unravels. And so I ended up not quitting, wow, which I'd learned. I'd already learned not to quit. And it doesn't make any sense, but I that's how I was able to deal with the most horrendous condition that I'd ever been in.
That's an incredible story, man. I'm sure there's some other incredible ones like that as well that can get into a lot of detail. But that's fascinating. In that moment, in those, you're saying to yourself the one thought at a time, one thing at a time. Is it just like a conscious dialogue you're having with yourself? Like you're saying those things to yourself in your head. Kind of unpack that just for a moment. Like, what is the actual thought process going through in such a intense, stressful, like life on the line kind of moment like that? What is it? What are some of the things that are going through your head? Is it a meditative state of mind? Is it like a very clear, just one single word at a time coming out dialogue, or is there something different?
Yeah, I call it an internal dialogue. That the process of producing words when they're freaking hard to come up with. Mm. So case in point, I'll try to articulate it. So there were around 12 RPG or rockets that are hitting outside where I was. Rounds are hitting right next to my head. I was trying to process where everybody else was. And I was trying to see the enemy, and I couldn't. And I was worried about, oh, my gosh, I have three kids at home. What am I going to do? I'm never going to see my wife again. And I had to actually yell, hey, Tom, move over to that other post now. Because you kind of have to yell yourself into into action. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it was funny to watch, not that anybody was watching, but I yelled at myself, hey, Tom, move now. So I moved over there. Hey, you got 2 seconds to shoot that guy. Ready, set, go. And I poked my head out from a window and shot a guy that had me pinned down. He was around 638 yards away. Then I had to do it again because I didn't know if I shot and hit him. So I had to go back into the battle and look. Because, if you know what I'm saying, when I'm undercover, I'm not getting shot at. But I had to go out from cover to shoot the guy. So I shot him like two or three more times to make sure. And then I had to process, how do I find my platoon? And I had to yell at myself, hey, Tom, run out to the next building and see if they're there. Because it's scary as hell. Because all I see out there is bullets. So I had to yell at myself to run out there. And so I did that, and I found out where they are or were. And then I had to yell at them to do something because everybody's trying to process 1,000 things and it's out of control. And you have to punctuate that with yelling at somebody. I laugh now, but it wasn't funny at the time because, the brain it starts processing too many things, and you have to shake it out of its stupidity into doing one simple thing. And words are massive and they're powerful and they're effective. And you have to have the loudest voice. And everybody has that ability. Just nobody does it. They try to process too much.
So those are actually, when you're yelling, you mean you're actually yelling aloud, like as if you're yelling at somebody else. Wow.
Yeah. Because if you do things quietly, it's you lie to yourself because there's 10 other voices in there that are loud. So you have to overcome those with, externally, on the loudspeaker. You're going to do this now. And they're, oh, okay, let's do it.
Is that something you taught yourself or is that something they train you to do?
Probably both.
Yeah.
And the only way to make a point in a firefight is to make it louder than the firefight itself. And either you're yelling at the guy that's doing something wrong or yelling at yourself, you have to punctuate it really loudly to process it.
This episode is sponsored by ButcherBox. For $20 off your first box and an order of free bacon, go to butcherbox.com/eliteman and enter the coupon code ELITEMAN at checkout. ButcherBox delivers healthy 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, free-range organic chicken, and heritage-breed pork directly to your door. The incredible quality of ButcherBox meat starts with a commitment to raising animals humanely and free of antibiotics and hormones. Each box comes with at least 8 to 11 pounds of meat, which is enough for 24 individual-sized meals. You can choose from 5 different box types: all beef, beef and chicken, beef and pork, the mixed box, or the custom box, which lets you choose your own cuts. All of their delicious meat is frozen at the peak of freshness in individual, vacuum-packed, biodegradable packaging and is delivered right to your doorstep for free. Think of ButcherBox as your neighborhood butcher with their quality beef, chicken, and pork delivered right to your door. I recently had the joy of getting my own ButcherBox filled with steak, chicken, pork, and ground beef cuts, and I was honestly blown away by how awesome it was. It was incredibly convenient, fresh, and most importantly, really, really good. For the healthiest and best tasting sources of meats around, I'm going to be getting more of ButcherBox meat sent to my door. For $20 off your first box and an order of free bacon, go to butcherbox.com/eliteman and enter the coupon code ELITEMAN now. Again, that's butcherbox.com/eliteman for free bacon and $20 off your first order. Another question that kind of just popped into my head, I guess, is do you think there's something like, obviously you have just this incredible willpower, this determination to not give in and not quit. Do you think that's something that you, that is unique to you, and say you have like this kind of special gift to maybe, you know, blessed by God or whatever, to have this extra ability to have that determination, that unbreakable determination? Do you think that's something that's unique to you or in some other Navy SEALs like you? Or do you think that's something that most people actually have? They just haven't developed it over the years like you have been able to develop it.
I don't think it's a genetic predisposition because I can't find it genetically. And we've tried. The SEAL program has tried to genetically predispose people to being a good SEAL. Mm-hmm. But everybody has the ability to focus, but nobody wants to practice it. And, you know, I don't call it willpower. I call it, you got to practice overcoming the tough things. You don't have to practice doing well at something you're already doing well at, if you will. You have to constantly put yourself into difficult situations and find a way through. Everybody can do that. And you know what, 80% of the people don't even try. Why not? Mm-hmm. Why constantly do the same thing over and over again just because it's easy? That's, you know, like trying to be 5 years old constantly. It's over. Do something new. It's not that life is difficult. It's life has new challenges constantly. Figure them out. Embrace them.
Yeah, and I'm totally about that. And I think that's a recurring theme on this show, is really just going after life and doing things that really push you and drive you into becoming a better, in this case, a better man, a better person. But diving into the book that you came out with a couple of years back, I think it's an incredible book. The lessons in the book, it goes right along with this whole mentality, I think, of being unbreakable, of having that determination, not quit attitude, never give up attitude. I'm just going to quickly run through, I think there's 13 lessons. I'm going to quickly mention the lessons, and then we can dive into some specifics of those and you know, unpack a few of those. But correct me if I'm wrong or missing any of these, but I just want to make sure I get them all out for the guys listening. So number one, honor your word. Number two, facing fears. Number three, pushing beyond your comfort zone. Four, committing to others. Five, twin pitfalls of success. Six, give up on being right. Seven, unity. Eight, finding a master. Nine is mastering the grind. 10, mastering choice. 11, burden of life. 12 is no return. Play big. And then the last one, 13, is failure. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's just start with the first one, and then I'll probably pick out a couple other ones, but going forward. So honor your word. What's the first lesson all about?
I think it was not intended to be the hardest one, but it has proven itself to be the hardest one for people. For everybody listening, I'll tell you how the book came about. My wife, Stacy, had asked me to write down what I was going through in combat for my children and to give them lessons that only I could teach them because I didn't think I was going to come back. So it was the idea that, hey, without you here, the kids have these lessons that they can learn. And so each lesson was kind of predicated on an event in combat that I was going through that I said, okay, I want you to learn this, not knowing that there was going to be a second lesson. And then something else would occur, and then I would write another lesson that I was going through that I wanted the kids to be able to do. The book was never intended for anybody to read, and the original title that I wanted the kids to understand was titled Spartan Woman, that the greatest asset a man can have is a badass woman. The publishers didn't like the title. So they put their own title into it. But so lesson one, I think, is the pillar of the number one pillar to be successful in life is to honor your word over time. And in the what I put in front of the kids is at night and in the morning, promise to do something physical and do it for 21 days. And now there's been 700 people doing this training that we're doing, which is do the 13 lessons. And 700 people have tried, and 58 have been able to honor their word, which I think is odd.
Wow.
And so, you know, imagine the key to being successful is saying you're going to do something and doing it. That's like that's the key. And very few people can do it. And because they believe all the reasons not to do it. Like the four number one reason, the four top reasons not that people don't honor their word is I forgot, this is stupid, it hurts, and I don't have support. Out of 700 people, those have been their reasons that they didn't do it. I thought it would be genetics, too difficult, whatever, but it ends up being some other weird excuse that prevents people from doing great things. And those are the top four reasons.
So I guess just diving into that a little further, so what are some of the ways that you've come up with to make sure people don't use any one of those, you know, ridiculous excuses to veer off track? Is there something that you can share with guys that will help them stay on track and stay focused to keeping their own word?
Yeah, the first key is to recognize that you're going to talk yourself out of it. You have to experience you talking yourself out of honoring your word. Once you can do that, once you've got, oh man, I want to make $1 million, or I want to be a better dad or whatever, or I want to run a marathon, and then you try and then you don't, and then you start looking at what are the reasons that prevented me from doing it. When you see your own reason, the next time it comes up, disregard it. It hurts. I don't care. You said you were going to do it. Go do it. Oh, I forgot. Well, hey, if you recognize that your reason to lose is I forgot, have a reminder. If you're going to be successful, you better have constant reminders to get up and go do what you said you're going to do. And nobody cares if it hurts. Nobody really cares. Not even you. You know what I mean? If that's going to be your reason, that you're going to have a self-limiting aspect of your life. And, you know, who cares if you're getting support? You said you were going to take out the trash. Take it out. Well, you're yelling at me. Okay, well, it doesn't matter. Go take the trash out. Because if you're going to honor your word, you got to do it. You got to find a way to do what you said you're going to do. When you discover your own BS reasons, you become a whole different person. But then you got to disregard them when they come up the second and third and fourth time.
After a certain point of doing this, is there like, say, 21 days or a month or a couple of months of doing this over and over again? Does it become a habit of people to honor their own word? Have you found that it's like easier after a certain amount of time?
Yeah, the 21-day cycle is actually a physiological cycle and a mental processing cycle that psychologists and physiologists know. You got to do something for 21 days before you say it's the wrong thing to do. So grind for 21 days, and then it becomes kind of imprinted. So if you can overcome the 21-day cycle, if you will, you're really more likely to do well at the thing that you're attempting to do. And, mm-hmm. But nobody makes it to 21 days. Once you get to 21 days, you feel like you have to.
No, I think, you know, across the board, if anything, you know, starting a new diet or new fitness routine or new job or whatever it is, like 21 days, 3 weeks is, you know, typically what they say it takes to develop or break a new habit or an old habit. And I think it's, you know, applicable for this too, like keeping your word. Like that's the basis of all these things, of breaking all habits, of starting new ones or embarking on a new challenge. What is number two is facing your fear. Is there anything, we touched on this kind of earlier in terms of, you know, how you face your fears. Is there anything else related to this that you wanted to make sure we add into this, or is that kind of covered already?
Well, yeah, I would say one thing that we didn't cover. Once you face one fear, you face them all. Mm-hmm. If you can face something that, you know, like cripples you, and I make everybody do a rappel and a climb on a 100-foot rock face. Not everybody's afraid of that, but some people are afraid to fall. Good. We're going to go up and face it. And you sit on a, you know, like halfway down the cliff, I make people stop until they stop being nervous. Sometimes it's a long time and sometimes it's short. And all of a sudden you start, okay, I'm not afraid anymore. Your heart rate calms down. Once you've done it in one place in your life, you can use that same process immediately in other things that are not even related. If I face public speaking, the fear of public speaking, I immediately can face another fear because I processed it. So turn and face everything that you're afraid of. Just go do it.
Yeah, no, I love that. Actually, what you just said leads into the next one, and also it's so applicable to things I've done in my past in terms of getting over some of my fears. So number three is pushing beyond your comfort zone. I've used pushing beyond your comfort zone, pushing beyond my comfort zone, in say speaking, public speaking, or taking a dance class or acting classes, things that were totally out of my element, you know, years ago. I've used those fears and then overcoming those fears to then overcome basically any type of fear that pops up in my life later on. And especially in terms of like speaking later on and talking in front of a few hundred people, like those things were really, really foreign to me and would have been something that would have been almost impossible to do 5-10 years ago. But because I was able to push myself past my comfort zone, get over those initial fears, I carried that into other fears that popped up later on. And so what are some of the things you recommend as well in terms of pushing beyond your comfort zone?
Well, so fear and comfort, I don't think are necessarily the same. That's why I put them in two different sections. Mm-hmm. The places in your life where you're comfortable are actually very damaging to you long term. Not that it's not good to lay down and get comfortable. That's not what I'm saying. But if you create a process to push beyond your kind of self-imposed limits or your places of comfort, your eyes will open up immediately. And it has to have a time derivative to it. So what I know, and we've done 19, we're doing another one this weekend, is the lesson three is actually, I want you to walk for 24 hours, and you're going to hit all these self-imposed limits in 24 hours. You're going to get tired, but you got to keep going. You're going to rest and you're going to have to get up when you're stiff. So all these weird self-imposed limits you can unwrap in 24 hours. And the people that have done it are able to transform what they do in the rest of their life by being okay with being uncomfortable in order to get where they need to go. And it's a great skill set to have. You don't have to embrace comfort. Really embrace being uncomfortable and push it and do it often. I wish I didn't have to do one every quarter, but I do.
Are there any other exercises that you recommend is beyond the walking thing? Is there something, is there other exercises that people can try that will also push beyond their comfort zone?
Good question. I've not been asked that one. There are other, so anything that you have as a limit, saying something uncomfortable that's uncomfortable to you, to somebody, is another massive transformation that you can have. It's difficult telling somebody when you're in a heated debate with them that you love them. That's very uncomfortable. Do it. Do it. It's hard. It's very difficult. It's not like even fear-based, but how you win an argument is not win it. It's very uncomfortable. You're right. I love you. I was wrong. Thank you. Boom. It's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's one way, but you got to do it every time it comes up, not just the one time.
Okay. So you're training people to do this all the time, push past their comfort zone, yep. like across the board.
Constantly. If it feels comfortable, then you're going to push it. And like even, you know, like whether you work out, say, you know, I'll just use a scenario. So you're a half marathon runner. Every once in a while, you got to go run a marathon. Yeah, like if you're a 10K runner, every once in a while, you got to go run a marathon. You got to get uncomfortable. In the process of doing that, you realize that even in the thing like the 10K, once you push the limit, you go back to the thing that is your forte and you're better. So wherever you are, there's a limit that is a self-imposed limit. Push it every now and then, not constantly, but push it. And you recognize that there's always more. Cool. There's always more inside. We just limit ourselves too often.
Yeah, it's like mentally lifting weights, right? It's not like, you know, you're going to the gym and you're lifting the same, you know, benching 200 pounds every single time. You're never going to get stronger if you keep doing that.
You never will. It's impossible. Yep.
That's cool though. So it's like the mental workout, I guess, if you're pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone to actually grow mentally and become more unbreakable. So number four is committing to others. What is that in regards to?
One of the most difficult things as a human being is to commit to other people and their goals, whether it be your kids, whether it be a lover or a wife or a husband, whatever. It's very difficult to commit to their goals so that they attain their goals. And it's a great skill to have, is committing to other people. It may not help you to do that. That's why a lot of people don't. Because it's a time suck, and you know, if you have kids, everybody, all the men that are listening, if you have kids, it's hard to them because it takes time out of your day to commit to them, you know, studying or something. Commit to their stuff. What happens when you do that is you can grow the people around you, as opposed to being, you know, I'm going to do my own thing. And it's a very difficult process for people, is to, you know, help other people achieve. And I thought the kids would benefit from going through that exercise.
Yeah, and you know, study after study too shows people that are like depressed are some of the people oftentimes that don't commit to others, don't help others, don't volunteer in different things or coach or mentor other people. Some of the happiest people in the world, consequently, are the people that actually do that. So there's something to be said about committing your time to others, helping other people out, and sharing your gift with other people, even if it's just a time thing. But yeah, there's something to that. As human beings, I think we all need that connection, and especially when it comes to helping other people out, and in that regard, I think it can be very powerful, obviously for the other person that you're helping, but for yourself as well. Twin pitfalls is the next one. What are the twin pitfalls of success?
So yeah, this is the biggest controversial thing that I put in the book, and a lot of people don't like me for putting it in. So one of the truisms of life is there are pitfalls to being successful, and there's two that I know of. One is hope and one is belief. Hope is really the lack of your ability to follow up on anything. So if you hope that the weather changes, you don't follow up and commit action. I hope somebody will pick me up, but you don't do anything to ensure that it happens. Even though, you know, the ex-president wrote a story about, you know, the audacity of hope. Hope is a crippling thing to have. Action is not. Hope prevents you from doing stuff. Like, I hope I lose weight. Well, hey, go on a diet and lose weight. Do what it takes to lose weight. And hope doesn't help that. Like, I hope my conditions will change. Hey, move, do something. And belief is what I call the absence of knowledge. The more you believe in, the less you test things. Like, I believe that, you know, this diet will work. Test it. Acquire real knowledge in it. And belief and knowledge cannot reside in the same place. So one way to look at it is if you, I hate the word, but everybody's going to be upset. If you give up hope and you give up belief, you will act. You'll just take action. You'll do whatever it takes to succeed.
That's very interesting. Yeah, because you typically think of hope and belief as two good things. You know, at least I do, and I think many other people do. But I think you're right in terms of having those without action, especially. Like, you can hope all you want. You can believe everything you want. But if you don't do anything, you don't actually go out there and make stuff happen, your life will never change. So I think it's good to put it that way and make it clear that, you know, that's how you're addressing things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, man. So the next one is giving up on being right. Is that in terms of argument, having those types of things?
What the world is looking at that now is it's called your emotional quotient. If you don't have to be right, you're emotionally stable. Every time you have to be right, you are emotionally unstable. And if you can give up being right all the time, shit happens. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like if you're a leader and you have to be right, then nobody else gets a choice. And you may be wrong. The problem with being right is you may not see everything. And it you know, being right disallows other people the advantage of their skill.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it creates isolation. Being right is an emotional problem that creates you being isolated from really great things.
Love it. Tom, we got, you know, we're about halfway through. I'll just rattle off a few more.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And we can cover maybe, you know, a couple of them. Between 7, 8, 9, we got unity, finding a master, which I love that title. And then mm-hmm. 9 is mastering the grind. Of those three, which one really sticks out for, you know, the ones that you want to share?
I think finding a master, I know finding a master is one of the greatest skills to have. Is if you're going to learn anything well, you have to find somebody who's already mastered it to teach you. You know, whether any enterprise. So if you're going to try to do it alone, you're going to stuff yourself. There are other people that have already gone up Everest. Don't try to learn to go up Everest by yourself. Find somebody who's expert in that field and put your head down and do what they tell you to do. And the old saying is, if you want to learn to go up the mountain, ask the dude who goes up it every day. They're the master. Whether it's, you know, athletics or business. If you want to be a good salesman, don't keep trying it by yourself. Go to the person who makes $1 million selling the thing that you are trying to sell and put your head down and do what they tell you to do. Mm. And it's the greatest way to learn, but everybody wants to do it by themselves. I got it. Okay. You got it. Okay. When you don't get it, come back. And most of, you know, most great people or masters or great mentors are so open to helping. Like, you know, the top judo, you know, person in the world loves teaching, but you got to ask. They're not going to teach you if you don't ask. If you go to them, they will help you 24 hours a day. In the business world, everybody wants to help, but nobody comes to them because they want to do it by themselves. And it's a terrible way to exist, but yeah, that's one of the threes that I would talk about.
Yeah, the recurring theme too for some of the most successful people I get to interview is they have great mentors or people in their life who've shown them good direction in terms of what to do, what not to do. It's just the fastest way to your success. It's the fast track to success is doing, following the plan of someone who's already been there before. They could tell you what to avoid. They can show you the pitfalls. They can basically have all that time that you would have failed erased in many cases. And 10, 11, and 12, we got Mastering Choice, Burden of Life, and No Return, Play Big. I want to make sure I cover the last one, Failure, mm-hmm. in a moment too. But of those three, what do you think is a good one to touch on as well?
Oh, wow. Just because I'm in the middle of training some other people at kind of playing big.
Okay, cool.
There's nothing worse than playing so small that the attainment of it doesn't do anything for you. The bigger you play, the more reward your life will be. Whether you hit it or not is irrelevant. Play so big in the things that you do that you have to constantly get up to do them. And it's shocking how small people play. If you can make $100, don't have that be your objective. How about $100 million? Not that the money is so important, but play so big that you're like, man, that shit scares me. Yeah. How many days do you have? Oh, God, there's not enough days. I got to get up and do something. Ah, that's a better life. Because it's so ominous that you, man, there's so much to do. Good. Get up and start doing it now. Don't wait. Do it now. And the bigger you play, the more urgent things are. And actually, you feel better when you have something to do than, I can do it 10 days from now because it's easy. And you unravel when things are small.
Mm. Yeah, there's something I think so. That's probably one of the biggest ones on this whole list too, because so many people fall for that trap. I think in life is just being okay with mediocrity and just being mm-hmm. average. And they have everybody I think has this innate drive to do great things, but over the years it just kind of gets lost in the shuffle of life, and so many people just get okay with average, with being average, with doing average things, having average things in life, and mm-hmm. Not really being happy because they're not pushing themselves. And yeah, I think going big is really the only way to go in life. I say this all the time on the podcast is, you know, becoming the best man you can be every single day. It's about pushing yourself, driving yourself. And, you know, if you fail, like you get back up and you keep going. But that's the beauty of life, is that you can keep going. And I love that one. So the last one too is failure as well. We touched mm-hmm. on that a little bit, but that is also one of the most important things, I think, in terms of lessons and takeaways here and being unbreakable. What is the biggest takeaway as far as failure goes that you've learned?
Fail often. That's the deal. I mean, all the other lessons are cool. If you really want to be happy, you have to embrace failure. Not that you have to lose $1 million constantly. That's kind of stupid. You have to be willing to fail. You have to want to see things through 100,000 times. That didn't work. Okay, what did I learn? Because failure is the teacher. Success doesn't teach you nothing. It doesn't help. Because you can't remember what you did to when you succeeded. You're like, wow, that was cool. I'm number one. What did you learn? That's always the answer. Failure is, okay, what did you learn? Well, I'm too fat. Good. Lose weight. I don't like to public speak. And you learn that by going up and going, oh my gosh, I locked up. It was terrible. Good. What did you learn? Then do the things that you learned that you didn't know how to do and go back and try again. Because failure is the greatest teacher. There is no other teacher. And a good mentor is just going to make you fail. Okay, try it again, try it again, try it again, try it again, try it again. And that's the deal. That's the ultimate lesson in life is fail.
Yeah, it's not something you'd hear often from somebody, but I think it really is the most important, probably of all the lessons out there. Failure really is the secret to success. When you can keep failing and learning from those failures and getting back up, I think it's the ultimate driver of determination and also switching things up so you can make it better and then succeed later on. Tom, it's been a fantastic interview, man. Really do appreciate you coming on. What is the final takeoff send-away message you'd like to leave our Elite Man audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out more about your book and your website?
Yeah, the book is on Amazon. It's Unbreakable, A Navy SEAL's Way of Life. I hear it's a great read. It has impacted a great many people. If you really want to learn the lessons, we have a website called unbreakablelessons.com. There have been 700 people go through them. The lessons have literally transformed people, even in Europe. They are hard. If you want to learn the lessons, go to unbreakablelessons.com and join us. So we take you through the lessons vice reading them in a book, and we direct them, and we're available to everybody going through. And I recommend them. And I love to see what people do.
So guys, make sure you check out the book. We talked about some of the lessons in the book today, Unbreakable, and then also the Unbreakable Lessons, which is, you know, obviously signing up for the course itself is probably going to be the fast track to your own success if you can follow through with them. And then, of course, like you mentioned earlier, honoring your word and actually following through on doing some of these things is going to be even better. But make sure you check it out. Tom, thanks again for coming on, man. Really do appreciate you. And thank you for your service to this country, and for your time today in this interview. I know our guys are going to love this one. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.